it comes back with the same. Every way you look at it, with every branch of science and modality possible for humankind, you come up with that. That's a fact. And anyone who wants to still say there's something there, that's religion.
Okay, so
oh boy, are you guys going to enjoy this one? So over several years of COVID, the media made a decision. No one would debate me. They were too scared. But finally, someone was silly enough to come on and debate me from the other side. And here is the result. Enjoy.
And today we're going to talk about the C word. No, not that one. But the other C word, which is equally as offensive, I suppose, at this stage. COVID-19. Well, I decided we'd have a bit of a debate today about it because I received an email from Dermot Dorgan. And Dermot Dorgan is a risk analyst and also a former member of ISAG. And I said to Dermot we'd invite him on the show because he wasn't too happy with some of the points that Ivor made and believed they were incorrect. So both of the gentlemen join me today, Dermot Dorgan and Ivor Cummins. Good afternoon, gentlemen, to both of you. But okay, so Dermot, what in fact were the problems you had with what Ivor said? We talked about the fact that Ivor made the point that he didn't believe the lockdowns were necessary. He believed that within a three-month period, we had the data we needed to understand exactly the mortality rate when it came to COVID-19, and we completely overreacted and protected the wrong group of people. So what was the point that you made, or what was the point that you believed he misinterpreted?
Okay, guys, quick one. This guy went on and on and on for the next 6 or 7 minutes, roughly. I'm going to synopsize and just cut it down to what he's actually claiming, what the argument apparently is, and then we'll get back to the actual debate.
I think it's hard to take each point one by one, and we'd be here all day if I did. I'd like to give my perspective, which is that we had 20 years to prepare for this. We had many warnings from experts, from professionals, from Mother Nature herself between the first H5N1 case in humans in 97, SARS, MERS, the swine flu, Zika. We had all of these warnings, and each one was an opportunity for us to learn. And of course, we didn't do that. We did nothing at all. We wrote some papers, and we went to conferences, we shook hands for the photos and all that kind of stuff. But actually, none of the work was done. So when COVID came along in the 1st of January 2020, we were completely unprepared. And as the old saying goes, we don't rise to the level of our expectations, we fall to the level of our training. And we had nothing in place. And rather than reacting with any kind of competence, we basically sat around and did nothing. And the policymakers did nothing. The experts failed to provide expert warnings.
Well, we did do something, didn't we? We closed down the whole country is what we did, essentially.
In March. Right. January and February, we had all that time in the world. There was warnings everywhere, but we weren't paying attention to them. We weren't listening. We were just thought, oh, that's just one of those things that happens over there. It'll never go over here.
Mind you, we had a situation going back a year before that where 500 people in that year had died of the flu. So it was quite common for us to lose a lot of our population. Well, somewhere between 300 and 500 of a respiratory virus at that time of the year. It wasn't uncommon.
It is. I mean, again, it comes back to the, you know, the preparation. If we had been preparing over the last 20 years, if we had put the systems in place, particularly with respect to things like surveillance, we would have picked that up a lot sooner. I spoke to somebody who worked in infectious disease in a hospital, and she said to me that, yeah, there were people dying in Ireland in December of flu-like symptoms. They didn't know what it was. We had the chance to put the systems in place, and we didn't do it. And so if we're going to have this conversation, or we're going to have a conversation in the future about what we do next time and how we do better and what we learn from this, that's a huge area that we need to discuss and that we need to understand. Because the sooner we find these things, you know, an exponential variable is exponential on the way down too. So the more time that you can save in finding these things, in identifying them as soon as possible, the smaller it's going to be when you do, and the easier it's going to be to deal with it. And then it can become something that gets taken care of within the public health infrastructure in the background without anyone in society having to be, you know, to even know about it.
I mean, the lockdowns going forward then, do you believe they should have lasted 2 years?
Again, I mean, the way I see it is just, lockdown was the only button that Tony Holland knew how to press, and he just kept pressing it over and over again. That's basically.
So at least you agree with Ivor on that point. That was completely unnecessary.
I mean, you know, if you thought ISAG were annoying to have to listen to in the media,
they were annoying.
Well, imagine what it was like being in those meetings when you're just getting ignored over and over again. What I would say is, yeah, there was a lot of stuff around that time that, you know, obviously my perspective is we nip it in the bud. You don't have to deal with these downstream problems. But if we do go to, say, the end of June when that you know, the lockdown is being lifted. They lifted it without any kind of a plan at all. And so it just became inevitable that we would go back to lockdowns because, as I said, that was the only button that they knew how to press. And it was the easiest thing for the government to do or for NPHET to do because all the burden was borne by the people. They didn't have to do anything.
So that's it, folks. That is the argument from the other side that we should have surveilled, done surveillance and moved sooner to avoid the catastrophe. So let's get on with the full unedited debate. Enjoy.
But let me just go to Ivor Cummins. Ivor, do you essentially agree then? I mean, I don't see too much of that you're actually disagreeing on, maybe apart from the latter half. But do you agree with Dermot saying that if we had identified it earlier, we wouldn't have had to press the lockdown button?
Okay, well, I'll run through the points made. I just jotted them down here. That's probably a good structure. So we said that, or I heard, that there was no work done, there was no preparation. We kind of came into this blind at the start of 2020. Actually, there was a full pandemic management plan in the UK. Ireland even had one. And the World Health Organization, I printed it out here, had a massive document that I downloaded in April. And it had everything about managing pandemics. However, all of those plans were completely thrown in the trash after Neil Ferguson's modelling came out, which was proven to be absurd. And they dumped all the plans and they actually followed China. That's a fact. You can argue about what the motivations were. So actually, there were loads of plans, but nothing was done about them. They were thrown in the trash and they followed China.
We were seeing videos. I mean, I even, as a presenter, was getting WhatsApp messages with people falling dead on the streets in China. So, I mean, I was looking at the same thing. I'm assuming Leo Varadkar was looking at and Simon Harris at the time as Minister for Health was looking at and going, Jesus, this is bad.
Yeah, but remember the New York Times covered that China had around 20,000 Twitter bots out trying to drive Italy into lockdown. So there's a lot of shenanigans coming from China, as you might expect. You know, they have their own motivations. But Diamond Princess, this is the key point on that one. Diamond Princess in February 2020, and Professor Michael Levitt, Nobel Prize winner in mathematical modeling, etc., perfectly placed, raised this. And I saw the same thing, not to compare myself to him, but my wife asked me in early March, should we get masks? And I said, why? And she said, well, this COVID thing. And I said, no, it's going to have a severe flu impact and it'll be the elderly. Because Diamond Princess, at 3,700 people, if there was mega spread, arguably maximum spread, on a ship with shared air conditioning, no measures, they got around 25% positivity. That's just in PCR. You're going to have a lot more that doesn't come up in the test. And they basically had a few people in their late 70s and late 80s died in the following weeks. And no one of the 2,600 crew that were not aged were affected at all. So you actually had that Petri ship and you actually had, and I knew, that these numbers would roughly roll out across the world depending on the level of metabolic disruption in a given population and the age demographic. And that's exactly what happened. The WHO last year, the OECD, they all published the excess mortality and it essentially mirrored the Diamond Princess and the data we had in February 2020.
I'm actually confused because, Dermot, I'm not going to disagree with anything Ivor said, and I'm certainly not disagreeing with anything you said about the preparation, although Ivor disagrees with some of it, right? But I'm confused as to what points. I mean, you sent the email because you disagreed with Ivor and you disagreed essentially what he's saying, but you kind of are saying the same thing, that the only button they had to press was lockdown, and that wasn't what we should have done. There were other ways around this, and, you know, and it was the elderly primarily who were going to be affected by it. So really, so what is the point directly that you're disagreeing with Ivor on?
Well, yeah, a couple of points there in his last answer. I mean, I think we're both agreed that, you know, what Neffet did was not clever. We completely depart on what should have happened. And we also depart on the analysis. So Ivor referenced, I think, the WHO's 2019 paper on non-pharmaceutical interventions. You're familiar with the expression, correlation is not causality. Right, I think most people are. It can be easier to say than it is. Yeah, I think everyone in general, you, Ivor, I'm sure, Niall, yeah, the listeners, I think everybody's kind of familiar with that idea. There's another expression from statistics called absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So in layman's terms, there's a difference between, you know, us not having evidence of something or us not being able to see it. That's not the same as it proof that it's not there. So if you look at the 2019 WHO paper, throughout that paper, they say over and over again, we have very little data, we have very little evidence, we have very little to work from. Many of the studies in that paper are simulation studies for that reason. And it makes sense because you can't, first of all, we have no long-term data on pandemics because we were only collecting data from, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Two, you can't do experiments on pandemics because you can't seed a pandemic in one country and then, you know, get half the countries to do border controls or lockdown and then half the countries not. Those kind of experiments just can't be done. So it's not actually possible to do the kind of scientific research that Ivor's talking about a lot of the time. It simply can't be done and it isn't done. And so if you look at that, WHO paper, throughout the paper, they say, we don't have a lot of information, right? But we're going to give it our best guess regardless. And sometimes they guess right and sometimes they guess wrong. But what Ivor's done in his interpretation of that paper, he's completely confused an absence of evidence for evidence of absence. And that's true for okay. many. I mean, I've got some of the quotes here.
Okay, let Ivor just respond to that. You're confusing it, Ivor. I mean, look, everybody has their own theory and hypothesis of the way things work. And I accept that. But you're confusing this, Ivor. You're kind of jumping the gun a little bit there.
Yeah. That's 100% incorrect. So just as a bit of background, if people don't know, I'm 30 years in complex problem solving. That's statistical inference, root cause analysis, comparative analysis, Kepner-Trago, and it basically makes the point that was just made by Dermot just trivial. We have lived and breathed correlation, not causation, for a whole career. So to be honest, the WHO guidelines, and they say here on track and trace, which in fairness, Dermot seems to only think that track and trace could have been done better. And the other stuff was rubbish. So we do agree on that. But it said it is not recommended active contact tracing because there is no obvious rationale for it. Now, they had decades, countless papers, countless teams working with many pandemic type scenarios that did occur, not big ones, and they came up with no obvious rationale. So to actually try and do things that you've spent decades studying and realize there's nothing there would be ridiculous. And remember, what we actually did was not only ignored all of that knowledge amassed for decades, but we volt-fast, dumped all the knowledge and copied China. Now, where is the evidence for copying China, I would ask?
I mean, Dermot, to be fair, when you talk about correlation and causation, many times scientifically, we do take correlation seriously because we realize that correlation can lead to causation. We just don't have the evidence to prove it yet. So in many occasions, you know, we have said there's a strong possibility that when this happens, this is going to happen. We don't understand exactly why yet, but we know it's there. I mean, that's correlation. It's not causation, but we do take it seriously and we use that data. So that can be used.
The point I was making, I was just using that as an introduction point. I'm not saying that correlation versus causality is the mistake that was made here. I was just using that as an intro to the mistake that was made, which is absence of evidence versus evidence of absence. Now, in the case of contact tracing, can I read out the rest of the quotes of what the WHO said about contact tracing?
Yeah.
There are few studies on the effectiveness of contact tracing. The effectiveness of contact tracing cannot be assessed from these studies. Evidence of greater strength is needed. Contact tracing combined with other interventions is effective in reducing influenza transmission in the community, but the effect of contact tracing alone is unknown. And then they say, Ivor's quote, active contact tracing is not recommended in general because there's no obvious rationale for it. It's completely confused paper. The WHO have confused a lack of information, a lack of data, a lack of research with proof that it doesn't work. And can I just say on contact tracing, we used contact tracing effectively during SARS, during MERS. It was used effectively during COVID-19 by some countries, and it'll be used effectively in future. To say that contact tracing doesn't work because we don't have randomized control studies on it is like saying that telling a carpenter that hammers don't work or that saws don't work because we don't have randomized control trials on them. We don't, but they still work. You don't need science. You don't need randomized control trials to understand some things. You don't need a scientist to tell you how to butter bread or to make a cup of tea. There are things you can know without a scientist or a Tomás Ryan or Ivor Cummins or whoever else there to tell you.
And I think you mentioned
Tomás Ryan there. I nearly shuddered for a second there. Tomás Ryan, of course, was the same man who suggested that COVID-19 was causing autism in the unborn child at one stage, which was crazy. But I mean, when you were with ISAG, I mean, you said you felt voiceless to some degree, or you felt that you couldn't say anything or nobody was listening to you. Why did you hang out with them, or why did you stay with them when everybody knew, well, most logical people knew, that ISAG had gone completely over the top? They were even worse than Neffin in some of the suggestions they were making, particularly towards probably the second quarter of COVID-19, calling for zero COVID and worse restrictions and all sorts of things. I mean, they were demanding that we didn't take away the restrictions.
Yeah, I didn't join ISAG as such. I reached out to a guy called Yadir Bar-Yam, who I'd heard on a podcast, and we got talking, and then he added me to a group, and that group happened to be, or became ISAG. Now, when I joined the group, I had some inkling that Yadir and myself were kind of thinking along the same lines, that we could get rid of this virus if we wanted to. When I joined ISAG, I asked them, I was like, so what's the plan? You know, guys, what's the plan? I emailed a few people and got no response. And it was only kind of 2 or 3 weeks in that I realized that the plan was just to rerun the first lockdown, except this time we were going to do some green zones at the end and it was all going to be different. Now, once I found that out, I was like, I basically spent the next couple of months trying to convince them that there were better ways, that this wasn't going to work, that this plan was entirely dependent on the people going along with it, and the people were never going to go along with it, which they recognized themselves in private but wouldn't admit it in public. And so I spent that time, because that was basically our only hope. It was our last chance of actually making any kind of positive change. But it was like joining ISAG was like, you know, the ship is sinking, and then you run to the life raft, and then you realize that the life raft has a massive hole in it, you know. And so I stayed with ISAG as long as I could, and I tried to explain to them. But by the end of December 2020, it was clear then that there was just going to be no change. It was lockdown from here on out, and there was no possibility. So I clung on as long as I could, and I tried to make change where I could, but it was all for naught.
Ivor, you are essentially agreeing with it, as everyone is saying, with the exception, obviously, of the preparedness beforehand. You are essentially agreeing with what he's saying.
So, well, there's one fundamental disagreement which is worth highlighting because it's the kernel of the whole thing. In fairness, Dermot used the word in the podcast I came across last night, deadly, and he talked about ships going down. I will state that that's entirely inappropriate because the actual impact of COVID was exactly what was stated in February 2020. It was overwhelmingly an elderly person's disease, sad though that is, and it was, as a doctor in UK repeatedly said during 2020 on BBC and everywhere, it was within the envelope of a severe flu impact. So to call it deadly and ships going down is blatantly against the reality and all the data's in now. It was a severe flu impact. Sweden had an impact in the pandemic year of 0.05% excess mortality, overwhelmingly the elderly, with no lockdowns and no masks. Even the UK, which was hard hit with an elderly demographic and severe metabolic health issues, I might add, they were 0.11. We cannot talk about ships going down or deadly because it's patently untrue by any reasonable person's definition. And I'll just add one other thing. The WHO, in collusion with Pharma in Geneva in 2009 during swine flu, they sat down and they agreed to remove severity clause from the pandemic definition. So when people ask me, was there a pandemic or are you a denier? Because some people deny it totally, which is funny. I say there was no pandemic by any sane person's definition of that word. So that's the most important thing for people to understand, you know. Now, just on the contact tracing, though, I would say, and people should read the book by Dr. Edgar Hope Simpson. Are you familiar with him, Dermot?
No.
Okay. Dr. Edgar Hope Simpson spent 50 years studying, and he wrote a book, The Transmission of Epidemic Influenza, and Coronavirus is the Same Transmission Dynamics. And he noted that there was a huge enigma that the transmission of influenza did not follow a measles-like simple transmission model. Therefore, you could never be successful in trying to track and trace it. It can spring up all over the world simultaneously on single latitudes, even before air travel. So there's huge science, which is well worth getting into, on the transmission dynamics. And I might say another thing, that he called out a hugely important point. Influenza has no serial interval. Now, I'm going to make this simple. A serial interval is, if you have measles and go into a house, 4.6 or 5.8 days later, the serial interval, a few people will get sick with measles because there's a direct transmission model. But he showed the data that influenza does not have that. And interestingly, in our own house...
Is that not what we went on with? Do you remember the famous R number that we all became educated? We all became scientists over the space of 2 years.
Because that is mathematics applied on underlying physics which do not properly exist. And that's where if you only focus on numbers and R numbers and epidemic models, which largely model what happens, they're missing the underlying physics of the profound nature of influenza transmission. So in my own family, I got to live out Hope Simpson's prediction and his data because my daughter got sick in February, I think, 2022. And I said, let's watch. So we were all sitting watching a movie with her. And we all sat together because, quite frankly, we wanted a COVID cert, you know, from PCR positive. And we couldn't catch it. And 2 weeks later, my son got it. And over the next 10 weeks, we all, in our time, according to profound physics, we all caught it over 10 weeks. And it was just a demonstration. So this whole idea you can track and trace, the WHO are incredibly incompetent. And yes, they hedged by saying they didn't have data, but it's no excuse because they had plenty of data to come to a conclusion, and they did. And then they ignored that conclusion based on politics, and they all looked to China. And I'm going to make that point again. That's important.
Dermot, just in relation to you, according to your misgivings at the start, that we weren't prepared for it, but I want to ask you, knowing that we weren't prepared, according to you, to what you're saying and your theory on it, and we went into it, let's take, for example, before Christmas in the first year, which is, I'm losing track of time, actually, at this stage, I don't even know when COVID was now, 2020, and before Christmas 2020, what would you have done if you were Leo Varadkar or Micheál Martin or whoever happened to be Taoiseach at that particular moment in time? What would you have done? Would you have just said, okay, there's nothing we can do about this, let's just protect the vulnerable, tell the elderly to be careful, et cetera, et cetera. Where do you stand on masks, for example? Did you ever believe they were the right thing to do? Because according to the most recent published studies on these, masks and lockdowns, and they studied various countries around the world, made little or no difference whatsoever. So even the HSE admitted at the start that masks made no difference. Even Luke O'Neill at the start on the Late Late Show said that we were watching too many horror movies if we even thought we should wear masks. And then all of a sudden, it was wear masks. So where do you stand on masks? Firstly, and secondly, what would you have done at that point? Would you just have opened the doors and said, listen, we just need to deal with it?
Yeah, it's on masks. Well, I mean, my policy, my preferred policy on masks is very simple. Every country should have a national medical stockpile of, PPE, multipurpose medicines, vaccines, etc., and masks, high quality masks. And at the slightest hint of trouble, you distribute the masks to GPs, clinics, pharmacies, health facilities, etc. If you want a mask, there's a mask there for you. If you don't want a mask, don't wear a mask. At the end of the day, whatever your pandemic strategy is or your epidemic strategy, it's not going to rise and fall on whether people wear masks or not. And overall, mask mandates are probably do more harm than good, I would say. However, on the function of the mask, again, we come back to kind of people's, I suppose there's 2 points here. One is that if the science was settled on masks, then it would be settled. The science is settled, for example, on gravity. You pick up a pen and let it go, it's going to fall to the ground. We all know that. The science is not settled on most of the stuff to do with COVID-19 and
was there not studies done on masks previous to COVID-19 in American hospitals when they were doing their studies in relation to influenza, where they got staff in the hospitals to wear them, where they noticed there was absolutely no difference, apart from obviously staff that were working doing operations and everything, because that's to do with droplets more so than viruses, that made little or no difference whatsoever. There were studies done for years before that. Gold standard studies.
Gold standard. Yeah, PCR was gold standard as well, you know. You don't need to do studies on this stuff. Like, a mask is a manufactured, designed product, right? You can test it in a lab. You can assess what percentage of particles of a particular size will get through that. And then you'll know, okay, to what extent it works or it doesn't work, and then you can make the choice of whether you want to wear it or not. It's part of, again, this is one of the kind of fundamental disagreements with Iver's philosophy versus mine. He talks about science, but really he doesn't understand where it's most, that it's a particular kind of toolbox for a particular kind of problem. It's not something that you just use everywhere, and that you need to have, he's kind of religious about it, like he needs to have a randomized controlled trial so that he can feel okay. Like, no, that's not how it works. So these studies that they do randomized controlled trials of masking in the community, and it's like, you're introducing a load of variables that don't need to be there.
But that's how we do. That's how we do all. Okay, but that's normally how we do all sorts of studies where there are randomized control studies. Yeah, but sorry, I would just answer that bit, and I'll come back to the other part of the question in a second with Dermot. So you can respond to that.
I must say I'm impressed. This is astonishing. Like I said, 30 years going way beyond the sound bites, in fairness, Dermot, you're mentioning. The mechanistic studies, because that's what we call them, because we do RCT, we do design of experiments, we do mechanistic studies, which are the masked ones in the lab, and we do associational and comparative analysis, and I could go on all day. We do that in every complex problem that we manage, right? The problem with the mechanistic studies is they give you an insight into control conditions, and it's useful information, but only when it's integrated along with the comparative analysis, the associational, and the experimental analysis, and many other modalities. So you're saying mechanistic studies alone, they're the thing. They're only a tiny piece of the pie. And you're saying that I say RCTs are the only thing when I've spent my whole life using every branch of problem solving. So I give an example, though. Here's North Dakota versus South Dakota. One had lockdowns and masks, and one had no lockdowns and masks, probably because of the politics of the governor. A million people in each, right beside each other, same culture, controlled for a lot of stuff, right? You cannot tell the curves apart of infection or mortality. I could multiply this by 10,000. We have myriad published papers that have looked at all countries, all regions, all counties in America, over 100,000 people. Always the same answer. There is never a signal. You cannot do every bit of analysis possible to a human, empirical and beyond, come up with no signal, and then maintain there is something there. That is religion.
Okay, sorry, Deborah, go ahead.
Can I respond to that? So I'm glad he brought that one up. Yeah, in all of Iver's presentations, he always conflates surgical masks, N95, FFP masks, and mask mandates, and he puts them all together in masking, in this catch-all category. That's not scientific. What he shows there is the two, like, if I was to be most charitable, I'd say, yeah, what that shows you is that mask mandates probably not going to work. But what that chart encapsulates is the mask mandate, which, you know, what masks are specified, we don't know. What were compliance levels, we don't know.
But you would imagine there would be some. Yeah, but look, even if compliance levels weren't good, even if they weren't wearing the N95 masks, even if, you know, some people didn't bother their holes, I mean, you would imagine there would be some difference, wouldn't you?
Sure. So what that shows
is no point.
Mandate. Well, no, because all these people could be just having a bit of cloth over their mouth, which is not, everybody knows that's not going to work. They're just doing whatever.
We all seen the Americans. There was Americans with 4 or 5 masks on them, for God's sake.
Sure, whatever, but this is a mask mandate. What he demonstrates there is suggests strongly, and I agree, that a mask mandate isn't going to work. However, in order to do science, and this is something that I don't think Iver understands in practice, is that if you're doing science, what you're doing is you're controlling for all the variables. And unless you have controlled for all the variables, it's not science. What you're doing is you want to have your input variable and your output variable. And you want to be able to say, if we change the input variable, this is what the change will be in the output variable. With all of this stuff, because it is a complex environment, because there are way too many variables, there are way too many variables moving all the time, you have too many options, it simply isn't possible to do the kind of science and to reach the kind of robust, reliable scientific conclusions that Iver is projecting in these environments. We need other ways of doing this.
Okay.
He's simply wrong.
Sorry. Can I please respond to that? So now Dermot has completely flipped from saying you just use mechanistic studies to saying you need RCTs, proper experiments. But the hedge and the catch-all to get out of it is to say you can't do them. Well, Cochrane Collaboration have done 3 full revs over 5 or 6 years, and because they're a real science outfit, they actually use RCTs primarily, but they validate with associational studies. Good way of doing it. They have come out unequivocally from RCT, and I think they had 80 plus randomized control trials. They're never perfect, but they're as good as it gets. And if you're familiar with forest plots, you can actually put all in one plot for all the studies, whether there was a positive effect or a negative effect or nothing, which is in the middle. It's one, risk ratio of one. The forest plots are the biggest joke I ever saw, because they show across the board there is nothing but noise from all the experiments that, in fairness, good teams put a lot of effort into, and they did control as well as they could. We're not going to besmirch them. And the whole canon of decades of experiments on masks came up with that. These studies all across the world with comparative analysis, which is associational by its nature, so it's not perfect either. But when you look at all the world and produce countless comparisons between countries in comparative analysis, it comes back with the same. Every way you look at it, with every branch of science and modality possible for humankind, you come up with that. That's a fact. And anyone who wants to still say there's something there, that's religion.
Okay, so we don't have too much time. So what I want you both to do, if you can give me a final analysis, Dermot, first, on where you believe, well, apart from obviously we know you believe we went wrong at the preparedness at the very start of it, but where you believe, even though we made a mistake at the start, according to your recollections, what we should have done. Should we have just, in the summer, or not even from the very, very start, should we have just turned around and said, let's just run with this? Unfortunately, some people will die, just like, you know, we do it every year with influenza, for example, where 400 to 500 people would die on a regular basis. Was it just a case of we should have just ran with it?
I'll give you a few bullet points rather than anything comprehensive. I think, first of all, we need to understand that this isn't a scientific environment. This is a risk management, a strategic environment. It's much more like war than it is like lab science. And so we need to use those methods of kind of decision-making in uncertain environments rather than randomized control trials and whatever else. I think that's the first thing. That's a kind of a philosophical thing. As for, you know, what we should have done, January block flights from China, block flights from anywhere where it was showing up. That should have been prepared and coordinated across the EU. We should have ramped up our testing capacity so that we could have done loads of testing in January and February, found out where it was. Testing helps to reduce transmission as well. You asked before we got into it on the masks about what we should have done in the second half of the year. I just put out as an example of a strategy that we might have used is or targeting. So we have a selection of public health measures, and we put them in place in such a way that we keep the R number below one, but in such a way that the rest of society can pretty much keep going. So we find a way to maximize suppression of the virus while minimizing the burden on the people. And if we had had kind of more intelligent policymakers when we opened up in June, that's something we could have tried.
I would agree, certainly in relation to Neffet, it shouldn't have been a group of people who all just agreed with each other. Well, although some of them have come out more recently and said they didn't agree, but they weren't listened to. So we shouldn't have had just a small group of people who had some of them may have had a financial interest as well, who just agreed with each other.
Oh, sorry, can I just add on that, that you brought up Neffet? I mean, the amount of, like, there should have been transparency, there should have been, their meeting minutes should have been a lot better, they should have been printed on time, there should have been much more oversight of Neffet.
And the media, Dermot, played a huge role in this, by the way. The media were almost like, you know, cheerleaders for Neffet. I mean, particularly RTE. I mean, the very idea at 6 o'clock every evening, no matter what was happening in the world, it didn't matter who was being killed, many mass murders that was going on. I mean, that this became the number one story of the news. You know, 10 people died today, which was some sort of fantastic news. 10 people die, or whatever it is, I think it's 35 people die or more than that. Die every single day of the week, and we don't announce it on the news. It was like some radio station from the middle of Kerry somewhere giving us the death notices every day at 6 o'clock. Sorry, Ivor, just finally, because I got to wrap it up. Yeah, it was. Finally, Ivor, I mean, in relation to how you would summarise, obviously, Dermot's views of it.
Yep, okie doke. So I got to hand it to Dermot, actually. You're the first person that managed to get me somewhat riled up. And kudos to you. And one of the reasons is that in Ireland, they realized very early on, as I mentioned earlier, that I was to be kept off the screen. And interestingly, I have an ISAG story really briefly. I think you'll like it. Are you familiar with Zero Leaks, Dermot? The expose by Grit Media about the...
Yeah.
So they leaked 1,000 plus, I think, emails. And I spoke to the reporter. And he said to me on the phone, the most astonishing thing about the 1,000+ emails, and I went through them all late into the night. He said, I noticed around 100 in that none of these scientists were really talking about science. So I kept an eye out and I got to the end of the pile. They were only talking about lobbying and achieving their goals, which were whatever, lockdowns and other nonsense. So that was interesting. And the second ISAG story, they did an article and asked my permission. Who was the guy down in Cork who did the malaria, got 20 million from Bill and Melinda Gates?
Jerry Clean.
Jerry Clean didn't say much, you said in your interview in ISAG. He said a lot about me because he said that fella, he's slippery like Professor Carl Hennigan of the evidence-based medicine in Oxford and Sunetra Gupta. So thanks, Jerry, for comparing me to them. I like it. But he also said I should be taken care of with a hurley in a dark place.
I remember that.
And he also said, on the record, he said what we need with him is a rigged debate and a rigged moderator. Now, what does that tell you about ISAG? But I go to your points. So you mentioned, Dermot, January we should have blocked flights. Well, you might be surprised to know that a cancer study in Italy showed that SARS-CoV-2 was in blood samples from September the prior year. In Brazil, they found it in the human sewage in November 2019. The first people were afflicted in the USA in January and the UK, I think, as well. I could go on all day. Blocking flights, you might as well, like, just whistle or something.
Well, you're going to pull those pistols and whistle Dixie.
So that's one thing. The testing we could have done more of. I would say, if I magically went back, and people should think about this, and I magically made testing not available, we could not have had a pandemic because we would have had seasonally busy departments and hospitals, maybe a bit worse than usual. But think about the mortality impact at the end of the day and the actual ICU. Sweden with no lockdown, no masks, right? Their ICU only hit 65% capacity at the peak. So if we had no testing, theoretically or in reality, in a sense, we would have had no pandemic. And we could have saved that 10 trillion we gave to the richest people on our planet and took from working class and poor people.
But at least Jared is nodding when you're saying that.
Yeah, remember.
No, I'm not, because it's classic. Hey, Jared, you stick our heads in the sand. There's no problem. No. We just pretend there's no problem.
Yeah, but hang on,
no
both
problem.
Of you. I remember. When the numbers started dropping down and people were going, oh, it looks like they might lift the lockdown, the numbers are starting dropping down. And I said, don't worry about it. They'll push for the testing over the next week. And sure, it was obvious. It was obvious. The more people you test, the more people you were going to find. Sure, I arrived into work one day. I was diagnosed with COVID-19. I felt perfectly fine. And I said, can I just go into the studio and do my show? They said, no, you have to go home. And I went home and I'm sitting at home for 7 days, twiddling my thumbs with nothing wrong with me. It was probably the first in my life, I'm 60 years old, that I've ever heard the term asymptomatic. So, in other words, a disease you have to be told that you actually have because you've no symptoms of it whatsoever. I mean, God's sake, lads, if you're going to test more people, and you know, Dermot, you have to admit PCR testing wasn't the best way of doing things. The man who invented the test believed it was inaccurate, for God's sake. I mean, they were amplifying it so much that it would have found COVID if you were 40 miles away. So it was completely inaccurate. And the more people we were testing, the more people we were going to find. The more people we were going to find, the more they went into a panic and started testing more people. And it just became this kind of knock-on domino effect.
Yeah, but let's remember, there's the thing itself, like testing, and then there's how it was used by the Irish authorities. So we shouldn't, you know, the thing itself has a lot of potential, but in the hands of a novice and idiots, then, yeah, it can be manipulated anyways. And I'm sure there was plenty of that going on, but I don't think that is enough to say that testing itself is an inherently bad thing.
And I might add, I kind of agree in one sense, but I'd add testing in the hands of the people who managed to keep driving this kind of mass formation psychosis for so long. Testing in those hands was unfortunately a disaster for the world. So and, the people
and I do believe when it came to the testing, they think there was a financial conflict of interest going on as well. But that's a whole other question. Listen, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed, Dermot Dorgan. I appreciate you talking to us today. Ivor Cummins, I appreciate you as well.
So that'll do it, folks. There you are, the ultimate COVID debate. How did you think it went down? Please comment below, like and subscribe, but most especially have the discussion below and let's air our differences. And as always, huge thanks to my Patreon and PayPal supporters. That's what makes it possible for me to do all the work that I do to help get the true messages out there and to counter the disinformation and misinformation from the legacy media mouthpieces. And I've recently been in the UK giving talks. I'm back over in April, I believe. And I was on Redacted again the other day and also on Unusual Suspects, which comes from Valuetainment. And they're a big outfit. So I'm getting onto a lot of platforms, getting a lot of views and getting a lot of the messages out there that we need for our children and grandchildren to counter the madness that is being foisted upon us in today's world. So thanks so much for your support, guys, and anyone else who can jump in and help keep the train on the track. Really appreciate it. Thank you.